Quasi-Cerebral Talk and Tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. You are tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We are the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on unceded stolen lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on unceded stolen lands of the Ketse, Kwikwetlem, and Tsleil-Waututh First Nations. And here at Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers and knowledge keepers of these lands, and we thank them for their stewardship of the lands and the waters. My name is Leslie, and September is Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. Today, I'll be talking about suicide prevention awareness. And if you have been a longtime listener of Typically Tuesdays, you might remember that last year in September, I also talked about this topic quite in depth. I will be doing so again today, but not as in depth. The reason why is because I, one, very frankly, just in alignment with the kind of like meta genre of like mental health things, my brain not working very well these days, very frankly. But the other reason why is because I don't want for this topic to go undiscussed. I feel like it always has a place here on the program. And when I'm able to do it on during the occasion that it arises, it keeps me on track. And it's better than not discussing the topic at all. If you listened to that episode of Typically Tuesdays, then you'll remember kind of like what my thesis of it was. And if you haven't heard it before, it's got a lot more information that I'll be discussing today. And it is also accessible on the CJSF archives at cjsf.ca. Please go give it a listen after this episode today. But my feelings on suicide prevention awareness have not changed. I believe that it needs to be intersectional. It is imperative for it to be intersectional and imperative for it to be political. Today, I'll be discussing the reasons why sort of the baseline mainstream way of how we talk about suicide prevention awareness is a good start, but it is not enough. Again, today's episode is not as formalized, not as scripted as last year's, and it's not going to be as full of resources and kind of like the science-y bit about suicidality and pain as last year's. For that stuff, please listen to last year's episode. Again, it's over at cjsf.ca in the archives. I'll simply be following my notes today and talking about some stuff that I've been stewing on the past couple of weeks. I should make note as well, I'm not a mental health professional and I am not a therapist. I am just a person with lived experience who has thoughts about this particular topic. Anything that appears like advice or solutions should be taken with discretion. So, as for music, we're going to be listening to some stuff that I've been tuning into the past couple of days, and that's pretty much it. Very straightforward episode, I think. Please listen with care, and if you can't make it through the whole episode, you know, I hope to talk to you soon, but I do hope that you consider leaning into discomfort. That's going to be a really important theme of today's topic. All right, here we go. Here is Yawn with Wading in Water.
Head in my hands, heart on the floor. I know how this feels, oh, I've been here before. I'm down on my luck, I'm kicking the curb. I'm clinging like honey to all of your words. But you got the love, give it back to me. Yeah. And you got the fear, won't you just let it be? Say that it's better if we just stay as we are. I think you're afraid to let go, and I think enough is enough. I've been wading through the waters, I've been crawling on the earth, holding at your hemline, but it doesn't seem to work. Don't you hang me out to dry, no, don't you hang me out to dry. I've been circling.
Natulog sa habang buhay. Makapiling ka, makasama ka, yan ang panalangin ko. At hindi papayag ang pusong ito. Mawala ka sa aking piling, mahal ko. Na dulot ng pag-ibig nating dalawa. At sana naman makikinig ka kapag akin sasabihin minamahal kita.
Panalangin ko sa habang buhay.
Makapiling ka, sama ka, sama yan ang panalangin ko. Hindi papayag ang pusong ito. Mawala ka sa aking piling, mahal ko iyong bingging. Panalangin ko sa habang buhay. Makapiling ka, piling makasama ka, sama yan ang wala ka sa aking piling, mahal ko iyong dingding. Panalangin ko sa habang buhay.
Panalangin by EPO Hiking Society here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I've been kind of listening to some OPM lately. That stands for Original Pilipino Music. And it refers to kind of like popular, easy listening music of the Philippines. I think it gained popularity in like the 1970s and was sort of like a mainstay of pop music of the Philippines up until like the late 1990s or something like that. Yeah, it's fun stuff. I mean, like if you enjoy like a fun little like easy listening pop song, get into OPM. It's a good time. My name is Leslie, and in a sharp segue, as a reminder, today I'm talking about suicide prevention awareness for Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And if you've been a longtime listener of Typically Tuesdays, you likely know that I often feel that the campaigns to discuss this topic try, but they can afford to go deeper in how they want to address this issue. The stance that I hold around suicide prevention awareness is that it must be intersectional, it must be political, and it requires us to commit deeply to empathy and care. These are things that I think that a lot of the times discussions around mental health and suicidality don't do very well. I think a lot of campaigns try to come at it from the right place to make sure that people stay alive. And obviously, you know, that's very important, but I think that it is a very complex issue, and it's a very complicated reality for a lot of people who are suicidal. And really importantly, that the concept of suicide isn't even all that well and normalized to be discussed. It is considered so taboo. It can be something that scares a lot of people and put them into such a place of discomfort that even when they say that they want to support you through a tough time, they aren't able to actually come at it, I think, from a place that does not decenter themselves. You know, this, there's a really interesting post by Stronger You Wellness that they put on to their social media. And Stronger You Wellness are, they're an organization that tries to support whole, quote, whole human, non-carceral wellness coaching and peer support for people on the margins. So, unquote. So they're very focused on how to make life a little less awful for people who are already marginalized and oppressed, who are experiencing what some may call mental illness. There's a post that they wrote, and they write, quote, Suicide Prevention Month focuses on increasing access to tools, resources, and treatment, recognizing warning signs, providing help, healing, and hope. We believe that these are all important. They should be available all year long, and they're incomplete. Suicide Prevention Month treats suicidality as a crisis or immediate danger, but we know that this is not always the case. Experiences with suicidality are vast and layered. Suicide is not as simple as crisis or escaping the pain. Wanting to die can be a normal and logical response to untenable and unchanging trauma. Related to neurodivergence or general orientation to the world, a relational event signaling an unmet need. They go on, quote, marrying suicide to crisis leads to carceral interventions, tools, treatments, assumption that suicidality is short-term, dependence on external signs of distress, prioritization of individual support and effort, and emphasis on aliveness as safety. Unquote. I think that post is really, really important because it helps illuminate the a lot of lived realities of people who experience suicidality, people who might be chronically, what we would call like chronically mentally ill, or people who a lot of the times, as you know, Stronger You Wellness tries to serve, people who are marginalized and oppressed, and they're not having their needs met. A lot of the times, these are needs that are absolutely imperative, crucial to not only our survival, but also the ability for us to lead happy, healthy lives, such as stable housing, stable long-term housing, such as food security. If you are a parent, maybe it's affordable childcare. If you are a person who is chronically ill, maybe it is being able to access validating, affirming healthcare. Even something that is often thought of to be very low barrier, which is community and social connections, a lot of people actually might not have access to that for whatever reason. If you are a person who is deprived of those things, you might not feel like you want to continue to live in this world. Does that not seem logical? It's not great necessarily, but that, does that not seem like a natural response to being deprived of joy, to being deprived of basic things to help you get through the day, to being deprived of accessible, affirming healthcare? In that way, I think it's really important for us to think about suicide prevention in an intersectional framework, because we also need to consider the experiences of people who are at the crossroads of multiple different systems of oppression, and how the systems of oppression deny them of having access to these very basic needs, such as stable long-term housing, such as affordable, accessible healthcare, such as community. And when you start from there, when you think about suicide prevention, I think from that angle, with that intersectional framework, it is also then not hard to begin to think about suicide prevention as being something that needs to be political. Because let's really consider, right, who are people in our society right now who are often being discriminated against? Who are people who are being, let's say, villainized in mainstream media all the time? Who are people who are not just being deprived of rights, but also losing their rights? I don't think that it is of a surprise at all that when we consider the suicide rates among certain people of marginalized communities, we find that their rates of suicide can be oftentimes higher and even more distressing than in the mainstream populations. But on the flip side, if we treat suicidality as constantly as like being a one-time crisis issue that your loved one will want to keep living again as long as they start the meds or as long as they start going to therapy, there is a potential that we are overlooking something that is constantly not being addressed, that could be the marginalization that they experience in our society. It could be experiences of oppression that have deprived them, let's say, of having a stable job, of being able to, let's say, access gender-affirming healthcare. It could be the fact that they have long withstanding unaddressed trauma that mental health professionals just have not been able to get to the root of. It also simply could be that is just how they move about life. And I think when we think about suicidality in that kind of flattening way, we really miss the opportunity to understand our loved ones more, and we miss the opportunity to advocate for them more. I'm going to talk a little bit more about suicide prevention after this music break. Here's the latest from Ribbon Skirt. This is Lucky 8. Enjoy.
Yeah. This is Bird Note. It's a sunny September morning at Red Rock Canyon in the Mojave Desert. I spot hummingbirds, flycatchers, and a family of gambel's quail. But what I'm really after are birds of prey, and I don't see any. As it turns out, desert raptors are being hit extra hard by climate change.
So desert species have a special set of challenges. We're really getting extreme warming in the Southwest.
Blair Wolf is a biologist at the University of New Mexico. He says that hotter and drier deserts mean less water, leading to fewer plants and therefore less prey.
And that leads to a general more difficult problem for raptors to find food necessary for both energy and water. Raptors get most of their water from the food they eat.
Which can lead to lower rates of reproduction.
They've got to be able to make eggs and then find food for their nestlings.
Heat stress itself, even a few degrees of warming, can be a cause of death for raptors. In recent years, we've seen record-breaking temperatures sweeping across the Southwest.
When temperatures aren't even dropping below 95 or 100 degrees at night until 3 in the morning, you know you've got a problem.
And it's only getting hotter. I get back into my car without seeing a single raptor. But on the drive home, there it is, a turkey vulture, circling high above the greenest grass around. A water-guzzling golf course. This artificial ecosystem is an accidental oasis for a bird, but it doesn't solve the long-term problems they're facing in the desert. For Bird Note, I'm Sonia Swanson.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie, and you just heard BB Bomb with Gisheng. I've been talking about a super light and easy to understand topic on the show today, suicide prevention. And we've come to the point where I think it's important to talk about why adequate care can be so difficult to access, and how we can actually care for people who are suicidal. To do so, I have to get a little bit personal here. And this is not something that I always like to do on Typically Tuesdays. This is very, very personal, but I think I have to share it in order to illuminate some things that I've been discussing on today's show. So if you have been a longtime listener of the program, you might know that I have a chronic mental health condition, and I also have many mental health problems. While I have surprisingly spent the past couple of years being able to manage a lot of my pretty severe mental health condition. I had a really big relapse a few months ago. And it was so severe that I could not put off specialized therapy anymore. And the reason why I had been putting off specialized therapy since I learned that I had this condition was because, I mean, it's very, very scary, but also because it was incredibly expensive. It is an incredibly, it is very, very expensive to go through this type of recovery process. So I had to start saving money. I had to save up a lot of money. I had to get a job first that paid me, you know, better than minimum wage. I had to make a lot of sacrifices in order to build up my savings. And I'm not talking about like, oh, I couldn't like have a little treat. I couldn't go on vacation. I'm talking about things that are bigger than that. I had to live also a pretty frugal lifestyle. I don't have insurance or work benefits that would cover this type of specialized therapy. But what I have been able to access now has been probably life-saving. I am in the incredibly fortunate position to be able to afford this therapy to address my chronic mental health issue that is going to follow me for the rest of my life. I am in an incredibly privileged position as well to be able to afford the price hikes that they're going to be applying to the specialized therapy at the clinic that I'm going to. But it doesn't only stop there. I work at a place that really recognizes that I need to prioritize my health in order to perform my job well. So I've been able to receive workplace accommodations, even though they will not pay me more. They can't pay me more, and they can't give me benefits that will help cover the specialized therapy. I am able to have more flexible hours. I'm able to work from home in order to go to my appointments and in order to recover after each appointment that I go to. The point that I want to make is that even though I had to be quite economically privileged to be able to access this type of therapy, money could not buy me the fact that the therapists who I'm working with are not carceral. When I open up to them about my own experiences of suicidality, their first response is not to get in touch with my doctor. Their first response is not to get in touch with the cops. Their first response is to ask me about how I'm feeling, about what I need. And I'm personally in a very fortunate position because I know from experience that most mental health professionals are not comfortable addressing your suicidality. Most mental health professionals are scared, even though they're trained to support people going through really tough times. Really, take this from me. I have been in therapy for more than half of my life, and I am not a young person. And in those many years that I have gone to therapy, it has only been very recently that I've started to work with mental health professionals who really care about listening to and affirming my experiences about why I feel suicidal. And again, the thing that I want to emphasize to you is that money cannot buy that level of care. Unfortunately, I know about a lot of people who paid hundreds of dollars for therapy and they were shipped off to a mental health facility the moment that they mentioned suicidality to their therapist. I have also been in the very fortunate position to have at one point worked with therapists who were low barrier, but who didn't flinch when I disclosed my suicidality to them. In my many years of being in therapy and knowing other people who are in therapy for a long time, I really do think that a lot of people, they have to go through 5, 6, 7 different therapists in order to meet somebody who doesn't have a carceral mindset. That can be incredibly scary. And so that's the state of our mental health care system, right? On the one hand, you have to be quite wealthy in order to access it long term, and you have to be incredibly economically privileged in order to access specialized therapies. But it's also about luck to work with somebody who is truly empathetic, who truly practices care. And there is a really huge impact in approaching suicide prevention, I think, from a non-carceral framework, in that, and it's that the person you're working with, the person who is suicidal, does not feel the great shame that our society tells them to take up when they feel like they cannot endure pain any longer. Their care has helped me lean into my emotions and understand myself much better. It has helped me open up to them for them to understand and help me address my needs. And one of the most important things is it has helped affirm all of the garbage that I've had to go through, all of the experiences that I've had, all of the struggles that I'm enduring. And I gotta tell you, a lot of that stuff is also ongoing. It is stuff that continues to trouble me. It is stuff that I continue to bump up against. But their care has helped me understand that I'm not alone. And it's really, it feels really good to know that sometimes when I'm really going through it. And I have to say, like, the reason why I share this is because, obviously, as somebody with a chronic mental health condition, I've gone through many moments of crisis, and I will continue to go through many moments of crisis, but I have seen the way that really surface, kind of like suicide prevention awareness campaigns have impacted the ways that my friends and loved ones try to help me through a crisis. I gotta say, it's really bad. It's really garbage. They're very afraid to confront the pain that I'm experiencing. I don't blame them. It's hard to watch your loved one go through a very difficult struggle, whether it be caused by external forces or internal forces, but it has also unintentionally isolated me. And in the same breath, I can also say that because I have received good quality care, I'm also able to pass that on to other people. And when my loved ones are going through it and they open up to me in such a vulnerable way, not only does it bring us closer, but I see how that changes how they approach caring for other people. It increases, I think, our ability to hold empathy, and also, of course, kind of creates the cycle of care where we want to be able to pass on the good things to other people who really need it. We live in a society that views suicidality and other mental health crises in general as these one-time happenings that can be fixed if we put somebody into a mental health facility. And as I've said now and in several other episodes of Typically Tuesdays and so on, the mental health care model, even though it has helped some people, you just hear too much. You hear too much about how people get abused in there. You hear too much about how people are getting objectified by the people who are supposed to take care of them. You hear too much about how it does feel like they are in jail. They are stripped of their access to their other networks of support, usually their most immediate networks of support outside of the mental health care facility, meaning that they do not have access to their community. They are considered, they are pathologized, right? They are considered subhuman. They are constantly being objectified. They're put through horrific levels of surveillance where even their most private, intimate moments, like if they need to go to use the restroom, they're being watched. That is very scary for me to think about. When someone is going through so much that they feel like they should not even exist in the world anymore, what makes you think that it is humane or right to put them through all of that? To treat them without dignity, to treat them as though they are animals or non-human animals, I guess you could say. Let's talk a little bit more about this as we wrap up after our music break. Here's the latest from Aquaculture. It's called Scotiaborn. Very cool track, and it also features Gary Beals and Haley Smith. I hope you enjoy.
This is Bird Note. Ornithologist Bill Evans has helped us better understand the sounds that birds make as they migrate at night. Known as nocturnal flight calls, many species can be identified based on their signature sound, like this green heron. Using special handmade microphones left outside overnight, Evans, his colleagues, and many volunteers recorded countless nocturnal flight calls to catalog and identify the sounds. But we're still working to understand these calls. Some are very similar to each other. Others have never been identified. Some of the many modern-day mysteries that biologists face. But for now, take a moment to revel in the beauty of the calls that birds make at night while flying hundreds or even thousands of feet in the air. This clip is from a six-hour recording of squeaks, whistles, and peeps from thousands of birds passing over a hayfield in central New York State. You'll hear a few crickets, too. Learn more about nocturnal flight calls and how you can record them on our website, birdnote.org. I'm Michael Stein.
Scotiaborn,
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 Scotiaborn. far, we won't survive. But our people thrive. I know you heard before. Scotia born,
Scotia born.
I listen to recordings of Helen Creighton's and get inspired by the voice of our late kin. If I'm a marker, I sit down and trace them. We settle here with a vision to succeed. No more auction block for me. So if you see a Scotian walking down the street, just know they was fighting for you and me. I'm honored to say I'm Scotian.
Ghost in which your elders make time. Trust in what your ancestors planned. Ghost in which your elders make time. Trust in what your ancestors planned.
Scotia boy,
Scotia boy,
Scotia boy,
Scotia boy.
We are back on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. My name is Leslie, and you just heard Fan Club Wallet with New Distraction, their newest single. Let's talk about solutions then on how to prevent suicide. Because, okay, we've talked about how it needs to be understood in this intersectional political framework. We need to understand that the care systems that are in place are oftentimes typically carceral and not helpful because they put people under surveillance and horrifically objectify them. What to do then, Leslie? Now remember and understand, I'm not a therapeutic professional, I'm not a mental health professional, I'm just a person with lived experience and who also has a lot of thoughts around suicide prevention. It does not qualify me to be a person who has advice worthy of listening to. I'm simply gathering some thoughts and consideration. We have to do something that I think, like, honestly, in our society, we are really crap sometimes at doing, which is to lean into discomfort. I think that what we have to do is to put our worries aside and listen to the suicidal person and their experience. And this can feel incredibly uncomfortable because we live in a society that sees death as taboo, as a taboo subject, but also that suicide is an even more taboo thing. But I think it's important for us to hold space for that to be a normal part of our society because it helps alleviate some of the shame that people who are suicidal experience when they share that they no longer want to be alive. Understandably, it can feel really scary, but it is also worth doing because a big part, I think, of suicide prevention is to learn how to decenter yourself and to center and affirm the person who is suicidal, who has disclosed to you that they are suicidal. You might not feel comfortable with doing that. I say suck up the discomfort, honestly. And that I think that's part of where the normalizing discussions around death comes in. But you have to understand that when somebody is going through that much pain, when they're going through that much struggle, it's not about you anymore. It's not about your emotions. It's not about your fears. It is about validating and affirming their experiences and understanding from where they're coming from. Another thing that I think is really important is to understand that the suicide prevention models that are mainstream right now, they are carceral systems. They were built on systems of oppression, but they exist in carceral systems. And there is a greater potential for people to be harmed when they are put into those systems than when they are not in them. I think potentially another thing that can be quite helpful is to stay politically engaged and informed. If you are asked with the task of having to affirm somebody's existence and they are a person of a marginalized community, an oppressed community that is constantly being subjected to, let's say, like governmental attempts to erase them from existence, for example, you want to make sure that they are affirmed in their life experiences and in their identity. You stay politically engaged, stay informed, and even potentially take certain actions, it will show them that you are affirming their existence, right? In doing so, you also understand quite a bit more about where they are coming from in their experiences of marginalization that might lead to their suicidality. Other helpful tools, as noted by therapist Omu Sella, for example, are resource redistribution as a form of prevention. For example, offering somebody mutual aid in the form of like cash, or helping them like cook a couple of meals. Setting up a mutual aid campaign could potentially also be really helpful. Creating interdependence by making networks where people are in daily reciprocal relationships, so that suicidal people don't feel disposable or alone. Also, offering care that people can actually say yes or no to, and respecting people's autonomy, two things that are super important. That latter one, respect their autonomy even if it scares you. Again, decenter yourself, so important. And finally, I think what a lot of people who have supported folks who are suicidal and people who have experienced suicidality can say is really effective is listening. Having somebody there who's able to listen without wanting to immediately fix the things that are happening or needing to sprinkle everything with positivity. Very, very important. It can be incredibly affirming to know that somebody is willing to listen to all the crap that you are going through and the amount of pain and struggle you're experiencing. So those are just some things in this very lighthearted episode of Typically Tuesdays. I will be linking some resources to the show notes of this episode of Typically Tuesdays on the archive at cjsf.ca, as you know, as I normally do. And I also will be linking the episode that I did last year, which has more details on like scientific stuff and additional resources, which I think are still helpful. Quickly running out of time here. If you have thoughts and you want to share them with me about this episode, you can contact me on Instagram. I'm at Typically Tuesdays, or email me typicallytuesdays@gmail.com. But I've been Leslie here on Typically Tuesdays, and I will talk to you again very soon. Bye-bye.